RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So to deregulation of GE and biotech. And we're here to discuss the government's plans to deregulate GE and biotech and the threats it poses to the organic sector. We've invited onto the program Charles Hyland. Charles is a soil scientist and biochemist who moved to New Zealand in 2013 after working at Cornell University in the USA as a scientist for over 10 years. Organic agriculture has always been central to his work and worldview. Charles, thanks for coming on our radio stations. Nice to have you.
Happy to be here, Paul.
In terms of threats or a threat, deregulation of GE and biotech here, on a scale of 1 to 10, on the threat scale, how much of a threat is it?
Well, I mean, threat is a broad term, so it's really tough for me to, you know, to put one number on that. But if we're talking from it from an industry perspective for the organic industry in New Zealand and the agricultural industry more broadly, it's up near the top. I'd say it's you know, it's at least a 9. The clean green image that New Zealand has overseas is it's really it's based in the belief that production here is natural and that products from here are more natural or, you know, healthier for people in the environment than products, you know, in overseas markets.
Why do you think deregulation is being toyed with then?
I think it's presented to policymakers, from what I gather, as a quick fix. Which is understandably appealing in, you know, when dealing with large systemic problems, particularly climate change. Reducing the climate impact of agricultural systems is complicated. And in order to effectively solve these problems, for good, we really need to embrace the complexity, understand all the factors involved, and make a series of small changes rather than attempting to kind of steamroll ahead with the status quo and add in one new element. It's really akin to, dealing with, managing human health and thinking that this new magic supplement is going to make a whole person healthy when, generally not what's put forward by objective third-party experts like a GP would say, oh, you need to look at diet, exercise, this, that, and the other, not just the new prescription that promises to solve all your problems.
Actually, yeah, that's a very good example because there are kind of parallels there, aren't there? The way we deal with our health and our natural systems in general in the bigger picture.
Yeah, not just in the bigger picture, but also, it comes down to biotechnology and these really powerful technologies that are genuinely amazing. Like I'm here representing the organic industry, but the bulk of my career has been working with conventional farmers and worked with biotech crops in field trials plenty, and it's not the straightforward solution that people may believe it to be.
But that's kind of common sense. You mentioned the policymakers. Are they easily persuaded, do you think?
No. I mean, in my experience, policymakers I've talked to in New Zealand of every variety are broadly thoughtful, well-meaning people who want to make the best choices. But for issues like GE, it's really a complex scientific issue, and it can be difficult for policymakers who are, generally not, scientists by profession, and they rely on the advice of experts. And it can be challenging in any leadership position to know which experts to make decisions based on their opinions and their advice, and you know, it often it can come down to where does the best evidence for decision making come from, and if the only evidence available is evidence that's produced from corporate funded research from organizations that have a financial interest in the results going one way, that's very different from, you know, extended long-term studies from objective third-party research institutions, like many of the great Crown Research Institutes in New Zealand, for example. We're currently in this situation where there's GE industry evidence showing potential benefits of products, and they're often simply aren't high quality studies genuinely comparing, you know, apples to apples. Do we use this genetically modified product, or do we try systemic solutions where, you know, maybe we change four or five aspects of how the farm is run instead of swapping in one, you know, seed variety for another? And often that work requires funding from the public in order to get done, and is generally lacking. GE products were introduced to the U.S. market in the 1990s, and it was premature in my opinion, in the opinion of many researchers, because, you know, scientists simply didn't have time to figure out what the potential or likely consequences would be, including things like genetic drift of GE genes from genetically modified crops to organic or just non-GE conventional crops.
I want to get into those risks. Another quick question. Do you buy in, maybe that's not the term, do you accept any of the arguments regarding climate mitigation strategies, I guess, in this area? Because some think that that's just a kind of a red herring to create an easy to digest and accept argument for this kind of tech. What are your thoughts on that?
I've looked into the ryegrass, you know, a reasonable amount, like as much as I can, looking through publicly available literature. And yeah, I don't see it as a real solution at all. And earlier in my career, I was part of the team that founded the International Biochar Initiative back in 2006. And biochar is these days it's a really big industry worldwide that is eligible for carbon credits for sequestering carbon in the soil in the form of charcoal. And it's very real, and it's very safe because we can know how to monitor the system. We put the charcoal in the soil, and then we can go back and check that soil and see how it's doing over time and make sure that it's effective and it's safe, and we can see how much carbon is there. This type of thing with, you know, modifying the feed that ruminants eat and expecting that to have quantifiable reductions in methane and CO2 emissions is, at best, it's very complicated and relatively unproven, you know, where we can't point to a study and see like, oh, well, in this other country, they did this and they proved it, you know, 10 different ways that it works. Realistically, if this does end up being approved for use in New Zealand, it will take years, if not decades, to really pin down how effective it is. And it would be to the detriment of New Zealand and the climate, the world, if it turned out to not be, you know, the quick fix that that it's touted as, because we would be, you know, we would be neglecting the pursuit of other solutions and the systemic change that that many scientists around the world advocate for, as opposed to substituting one product for another. That you know, we don't want to put all our eggs in one basket and then dust our hands and say, problem solved.
Yeah. Decades and decades is hardly a quick fix, is it?
No, because it's very difficult to see, you know, to measure climate emissions. It involves, you know, models and like estimates layered on estimates. And that's not to say that it's not accurate. It's just to say that it's complicated, and, you know, science is getting better at improving the precision of computer models, but it's not as straightforward as just being able to go out to the paddock and measure the emissions. Unfortunately.
Cross contamination. What happens there? How does that work? And what could be the results of that cross contamination? And how likely is that to occur?
It would be inevitable if GE products were just universally approved. And it comes down to, it really comes down to the public and policymakers, I believe, you know, being done a disservice by the very term GE or GMO, because it's lumping together a number of extremely different technologies that produce extremely different biological products. So if we're looking at ryegrass as an example, ryegrass can produce vegetatively, meaning, you know, it'll grow its root system sideways and put up new shoots and, you know, just kind of growing that way. But it's also what's called open pollinated, where it produces pollen and, you know, fertilizes other members of its species, and that pollen can drift. So it's extremely important before, in my professional opinion, and just my personal opinion, it's extremely important to, at the very least, have extremely reliable hard data to show how likely genetic drift is, and take it a step further and define the most effective ways to minimize and control it. You know, whether a farm system is organic or conventional, GMO or not, it's different than nature. And it needs a, you know, a buffer of some sort around it to, you know, to protect, you know, land in a natural state from land that's, you know, under intensive human activity, whether it's the ag industry or any other industry. And I have not seen reports yet that clearly show in the very windy New Zealand, you know, farm system how this specific crop, you know, will affect, you know, crops in the neighboring paddock, or, you know, tens of meters or a kilometer. It's really unknown. And that, you know, from a safety perspective, that's essential, like baseline initial information that we would want to have. This isn't just theoretical. I mean, like 20 years ago, there was a very famous case in North America where a farmer suffered consequences for a genetic drift from a neighboring property, and it's not impossible. There are examples that we can look to overseas. And it really comes down to what steps are we willing to take for short-term gains. And it's not a matter of like New Zealand being, I mean, to me, it's not a matter of just the cost and benefits of GMOs. it's really about the context of New Zealand. This is such an amazing place in the world. I mean, I've been fascinated by New Zealand since I was a child, when I first learned about the plants and animals that live here.
Yeah.
It's like nowhere else on Earth, genetically. And as I later learned, like, as a scientist, it's the last major landmass on Earth to be populated by human beings.
Yep.
About 1,000 years ago. So in terms of, like, globally, what does nature look like? New Zealand isn't just a symbol of that. It's a genetic repository of species that have no close relatives anywhere. And it's something that I think needs to be considered when it comes to GMOs, because one species isn't really just what we're talking about here.
It sounds like we're some kind of ark, you know, sitting at the bottom of the world.
We really are. I mean, as a young scientist, two places in the world that I'd never been to, like, just fascinated me through and through. And it was New Zealand and Madagascar, because it's like the closest thing to another planet that we have in terms of nature.
Boy, I never thought of us like that. And you've got me thinking new thoughts now. And obviously, if there is cross-contamination, any genetic contamination of organic crops, it's all over, really, isn't it, for certification, for maintaining that edge in organics? Gone.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm here representing the Soil and Health Association, which, has a clear, you know, interest in the organic industry and wanting it to be, you know, to grow and flourish. But it also, you know, represents the organic community. And this is really, I mean, this is at least as much an issue for the organic community in New Zealand as it is for the industry. And here's why. So overseas, where in countries where GMOs are, you know, standard practice in conventional farming, the organic market is differentiated by being GMO free. In addition to all of the other, you know, requirements for organic certification, that's built into it. And so, yeah, in overseas markets that are, you know, their organic industries are further differentiated from the conventional guys because they're not doing GMOs. And New Zealand, in my professional opinion, I think New Zealand hasn't all fully capitalized on its GMO free status. It's something that, like, I didn't even know about until I already moved here. And so I think commercially, you know, in other countries overseas, Japan, the US, like, there's a price premium for GMO free that I think New Zealand hasn't fully explored yet. And
that's where we should be going for value anyway, and also image. What about the legal and liability issues if any crops contain GE traits through this kind of drift, this cross-contamination? Does that expose growers to liability sort of automatically? Is that another risk there?
That's as much a legislative issue as it is a scientific issue. It's absolutely possible for many open pollinated and even close pollinated species to accidentally end up on neighboring properties. It's a very complicated legal issue to say would a neighboring property be held legally accountable. That's really something that policymakers would need to set in stone themselves, and it could be complicated because of the nature of international patents from the companies that produce and patent GMOs.
At the very least, it's another complication.
It's a major concern that needs to be addressed before the rollout of of any GE species are approved, in my opinion.
And in terms of pesticides and other things that are associated with genetically modified crops, that can drift as well, can't it?
It absolutely can. And this is another area where GE crops are not, they're not a monolith. They're very much a mixed bag. And so if we were to look at glyphosate tolerant, or commonly known as Roundup Ready crops, there have been many examples overseas of those crops specifically resulting in excessive amounts of the glyphosate herbicide being used. And they're one of the most, you know, it's one of the most widely grown GE technologies in the world. They have, you know, more species all the time that they're cranking out. But if we look at something like BT maize, it's a genetically modified version of maize that has genes from a soil bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis inserted into the maize, and it prevents a rootworm from pursuing the maize. And that, like, by putting that gene in there, it essentially substituted for spraying the Bacillus thuringiensis soil bacteria all over the place, which is what organic producers use. It's one of the most effective organic herbicides. So that's a very different GMO crop from Roundup Ready crops and from the ryegrass that we're talking about in the New Zealand context. So it's very much species specific and you know what technology was used to produce it specific, and plants, you know, no matter what kind they are complicated living organisms, and they need thorough study of their life cycle to begin to understand what the risks really are.
I think the argument here, and I think the National Party, but I guess by association, our coalition government, they've referenced Australia's and the European Union's adoption of gene technology and the claim that we could be left behind. Is that a strong argument? We could be left behind?
It's really not clear. I mean, being left behind, if the group is going in an unsustainable direction, sounds just fine to me. It's really difficult to make big, broad, sweeping claims about, you know, GMOs are like this because they're so diverse. But and this is more anecdotal. This isn't the result of like a study that I've done, but just in my experience, I've never met a conventional farmer who said, who had the opinion, I don't know where I'd be without these GMOs. I've never heard a conventional farmer say to me, I'm making significantly more money than I used to now that we have GMOs. That's not to say that people don't reap benefits, but it's not a black and white, you know, issue at all.
If you're hunting for patents, though, that part of the industry, let's say, you could see why maybe that claim is made. It's not actually in the field. It's just gathering saleable, what looks like saleable intellectual property.
Yeah.
Do you think, given our size, now, as I understand it, your fascination with New Zealand, we're not very big. We can't compete in this space, really, anyway, can we? We just would be a little niche player.
I couldn't disagree more. And I mean, I changed my life to, you know, uproot myself and move here because what you have is so unique, and it's not just the nature. It's like the national identity. I'm not aware of another, like, you know, significantly large country in the English-speaking world that has agriculture as its dominant industry. And that's really significant because elsewhere around the world, agriculture is often taken for granted, and other manufacturing industries and other more extractive industries are placed above it often in the decision-making process. And New Zealand is by and large, it's occupied by and run by farmers more than anywhere else.
Yeah.
And so it's appropriate for the best interest of the individual farmers to be placed with the highest priority, rather than companies that supply those farmers with their products. They shouldn't be prioritized above the best interest of the farmers.
I think you might have already covered just by describing some of the other points that we talked about, but I suppose there are plenty of lessons to be learned in advance of any consideration of this from overseas experience. I think you've touched on a few of those, and you would hope that policymakers and decision makers would be well aware of those before making any decisions. You wonder.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have any inside, experience with, what information they're privy to. But I imagine that, just like in science, that the information that they receive, needs to be taken with a grain of salt, depending on who produced it and what conflict of interests, may appear there. If somebody's, lobbying for a product to be, to be approved on behalf of the company that sells it, it really takes, if we don't have, equal funding to do research on other alternatives, at the very least, I hope the policymakers place a lot more weight on studies from, independent, either government funded or other like impartial third party research funding to really base decisions on, because whether it's this issue or anything else in life, the absence of evidence is not the same as the evidence of absence. So just because facts have not been discovered, that does not make them untrue by default. It just means that proper research hasn't yet been done to answer those specific questions. And so, the high potential of GE industry studies, that they may point out doesn't, is far from the be all and end all. And we really need to holistically look at things in a scientific way.
Well put. Thank you for coming on our program. It's really been interesting speaking with you, Charles. Charles Hyland, soil scientist and biochemist. And lovely words you had to say about our country. I feel good about that. And I hope it's been all that you expected to be. And maybe we'll talk again. We'll certainly be keeping an eye on this for sure. So thanks for coming on.
Look forward to it, Paul.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.